Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Coming up on the program, the economics of drug sentencing, something called a hyperloop, and a plane ride with the Atlantic Magazine, a new project called American Futures starts today. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Make it a working lunch. Listen to the Marketplace Midday Update podcast for the day's top business headlines. Subscribe on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace podcast for Monday. It's the 12th of August. Good, as always, to have you with us, everybody. Eric Holder, the Attorney General of the United States, went out to San Francisco today to make a speech. And in the way these things go, we knew what he was going to say even before he opened his mouth. The Obama administration wants a serious overhaul of mandatory drug sentencing guidelines. Convictions on certain charges right now can carry automatic, lengthy, and expensive prison sentences. Marketplace's Mark Garrison has more on the economics of Holder's thinking.
Holder threw out some big and optimistic numbers when he talked to the American Bar Association today about potential savings from rolling back mandatory minimums.
Such legislation will ultimately save our country billions of dollars while keeping us more safe.
But to get anywhere near billions, he needs Congress. Without new laws, Holder can't do much more than what he announced today. He's ordering the Justice Department to change how it charges certain low-level, nonviolent drug offenders. Preventing them from serving mandatory minimums will save money, but not billions.
Probably up to $700 million over 10 years by not having those people incarcerated in federal facilities.
That's the rough estimate of Urban Institute senior fellow John Roman. The only hope of getting billions in savings would be new laws handing sentencing judgment back to judges. There is bipartisan support. A Senate bill to do just that is the joint project of Republican Rand Paul and Democrat Patrick Leahy. Mark Levin is with Right on Crime, a conservative group that says prison spending is out of control.
I'm excited, and I think the announcement today by the Attorney General will hopefully add momentum to what many policymakers, including many conservatives, are already advocating.
In the drug wars of decades ago, politicians in both parties pushed mandatory minimums. It was an easy way to appear tough on crime. Prisons filled up and taxpayers paid hefty bills. Many states have moved away from mandatory sentences and gotten better public safety results through cheaper options, like special drug courts, enhanced probation, and addiction counseling. Holder's move today is an early step in the federal system's attempt to do the same. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
Elon Musk must not have enough time on his hands, I guess. That is maybe the best explanation for the latest idea from the guy who founded Tesla, the electric car company, and SpaceX, the rocket people. Today's offering is something called Hyperloop, the basic gist of which Musk released this afternoon. A way he promises, or suggests is probably a better word, to transport people from L.A. to San Francisco in one half of 1 hour. Liz Gaines of All Things D is here to make me smart. Liz, thanks for coming on.
Thank you.
So Hyperloop, really? What is this thing?
It is an entirely theoretical idea that Elon Musk has come up with. It's a high-speed transit plan that would supposedly get you from L.A. to San Francisco in under an hour, more like half an hour.
And if it wasn't Elon Musk, we would all be going, come on, get out of here. But this guy, I mean, he's done some stuff.
He has. I mean, he, you know, all this stuff that we thought was science fiction, he actually goes and, you know, reads the physics textbooks and figures out what people haven't thought of before and then spends billions of dollars to make it done or closer to done than it was before. So he famously helped start PayPal. Yep. That was less science fiction, you know, just getting money from people to people. But more recently, he's in charge of both Tesla and SpaceX. So Tesla is the electric car company that hasn't failed, which is pretty unusual in that business.
That's right.
And SpaceX is trying to get humans to Mars. And they've actually gotten some rockets in the air.
Yeah, they have. They've done pretty well. This, however, is a step beyond for two reasons. One, he's just kind of throwing these plans out there open source. And two, he says he's not going to be able to run it.
Yeah, I mean, I think at this point with Tesla being a public company, he has to be a little bit more careful of his time, as careful as someone who runs two companies and also founded Solar City, the big residential solar installer, and, you know, dreams up this stuff in his spare time could be. He just tweeted today that he pulled an all-nighter finishing up the Hyperloop. So I think it's clearly in very polished form at this point. But I think if anyone can push people's thoughts forward, it would be Elon Musk. And I think it would be actually kind of fun if Hyperloop becomes part of the vernacular. Next time you're complaining about your bus being late, you say, oh, wouldn't it be great if there were a Hyperloop?
I know. And honestly, it would be cool, right? Here to LA to San Francisco in 30 minutes, that'd be nuts.
Yeah. Elon Musk has described this as a cross between a Concorde jet, a railgun, and air hockey table.
Well, you know what it makes me think of? I'm dating myself here, but those pneumatic tubes that offices had in the 70s, where you stick
a piece
of paper
in. Yes, just put yourself in one of those.
Right, that's exactly it. Now, how does your brain not get ripped out of your body when you're sucked along at whatever it's going to be, 700 miles an hour?
Yeah, I mean, I think they're unveiling the plans, not the safety commitments yet.
that's exactly right. This is a little bit, there is demand for this kind of traffic. I mean, we could use it here in California. I'm sure there will be a need for it and call for it on the East Coast if they would ever get it there. It's a little bit the market meeting demand.
I think so. I mean, there's so much discussion about, you know, what's in front of us, just getting from one place to another. So in a way, this is almost like, you know, more exciting and accessible than going to the moon. I mean, Elon Musk has described Mars as, you know, a fixer-upper of a planet, which is a funny way to think about it if you think that big. But I think a lot of us don't think that big. We just want to get, you know, to LA faster.
Yeah. Liz Gaines at All Things D. Liz, thanks a bunch.
Thank you.
On Wall Street today, Hyperloop, Schmiperloop. There wasn't much of anything going on at the corner of Wall Street and Broad. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Another 3,000 Syrians crossed the border into Turkey today. That's a guess, of course, after what rebels in Syria say was a government bombardment in a province in the northern part of that country. Since the civil war started a bit more than 2 years ago, Turkey has taken in about 500,000 Syrian refugees. And now the Turkish government is trying to figure out what to do with them. From Gaziantep, Turkey, Elisa Roth reports.
At a school for Syrian refugees in Gaziantep in southern Turkey, the photojournalists are jostling for a good shot. As the Turkish foreign minister, Ahmet Davutoğlu, tosses toys to a classroom of little kids. There are plastic trucks for the boys, soft pastel dolls for the girls. Sufi Atan works on the Syrian refugee issue for the foreign ministry. He says Syrians have no official refugee status in Turkey, but they are welcome here.
Until they feel that Syria is secure and stable, they can stay. We'll never force them to go back to Syria until they themselves desire.
Atan says about 500,000 Syrians have taken refuge in Turkey. And that's an expensive proposition. He says the country spent more than $1 billion so far. About 200,000 Syrians are living in the 23 camps Turkey has built to house them. The rest are living side by side with Turks in villages and cities across the country. Idris Hamo arrived in Turkey 2 months ago from Aleppo, which is the largest city in Syria. And like many people from that area, he has Turkish relatives.
They aren't such close relatives, but they helped us. They suggested that we come, and they helped us find this house.
And they also helped him and other family members find jobs. But locals worry that even Syrians like Hamo are a strain on Turkey's infrastructure and economy. They complain the newcomers are taking their jobs and driving up real estate prices. Setar Canioğlu is responsible for refugees in Gaziantep, organizing things like language training and classes that prepare Syrian students for Turkish universities. He says that helping the refugees is a humanitarian duty, but even that has limits.
People here are really willing to share their bread with the Syrians. But what we desire most is to see the day when this disaster will be finished and send those people back to their country.
Back at the elementary school, the toys have been handed out. The foreign minister's photo op is finished. The school day is over and the students rush out. The scene could be a metaphor for Turkey's view of how the Syrian refugee crisis should end. We've been very generous. Now it's time to go home. In Gaziantep, Turkey, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
We got an email a while ago from James Fallows, the national correspondent for The Atlantic magazine, with an idea for a project. A collaboration, really, building on America's history of serial journalism, the tradition of discovering things about this country and about ourselves, one small city at a time. Only this time by air, in Jim's plane. Lots of meetings and brainstorming sessions later, Jim started out on the road for our series that we're calling American Futures. I'm going to join him later this week out in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. But right now, he's at his first stop on the trip in Holland, Michigan. Jim, I got to tell you, it's a great pleasure to have you with us.
Hello, Kai. Nice to talk to you.
I want to start and throw to you with a question that you put in your very first post on this trip about Holland, Michigan, on the Atlantic website. Why and why here? Why do you find yourself in Holland?
Well, this is the beginning of a trip we're going to be doing, trying to go to smaller towns in America that have interesting economic stories, technological stories, stories of demographic adjustment, parts of the American saga that are often left out of our normal news coverage. I usually live in Washington, D.C., so this is a change. And so Holland we've started with because of its unusual industrial story.
Tell me a little bit more about that. I mean, there's lots there that I think people might not know.
Right. Well, Holland is a place that I think is known in Michigan, but not necessarily worldwide. And when it is known worldwide, it's for its almost ye oldie curiosity shop type Dutch aspects. But it also has been for a long time the center of real manufacturing clusters. There was a long time a shipbuilding industry here. It's on a small lake that connects to Lake Michigan. That's become now an industry making turbine blades for these giant windmills you see around the country. Most of the world's office furniture is made in the immediate radius of Holland from Herman Miller or Hayworth or Steelcase. So at a time when we wonder whether manufacturing is viable in America, in the Rust Belt, in the upper Midwest, et cetera, this is a place that has a lot of it right here.
You're talking to a public radio audience here, Jim. I think everybody out there knows Herman Miller and the Aeron chair, right?
Yes. Some of the big hotels here in Holland, they have dual sets of both Herman Miller and Hayworth furniture so that when delegations are coming in from one company or another, they can swap out the sets for an appropriate feel.
That's perfect. What are you hearing from people in Holland as you go about the city and ask them these questions that you have in mind as you start this trip? What do they want you to know?
What is so interesting is that what's an urgent question in most of the country, which is how are we going to get the economy going again, less urgent here. I mean, obviously, unemployment is a problem here, as it is any place, but there are these very big, very successful, and very relatively stable locally based businesses. And so instead, two of the main things that have come up just in these past few days we've been here is, number one, the ongoing effects, both good and complicating, of demographic change. There's a very large migrant worker population here, mainly Latino, that comes for the agricultural works, blueberry picking, the world's largest pickle plant, et cetera. And so the effects of ethnic change on school systems, on social order or whatever, that's one thing that is you wouldn't expect to be the case in a town called Holland, Michigan, but is. The other is some very interesting recent debates on gay rights.
Part of the reason this trip stands out, and part of the reason it works, I guess, is because you're doing it by air. You're doing it in your own plane. Tell us about that.
The plane is a Cirrus SR-22, which is made by the Cirrus Aircraft Company of Duluth, Minnesota, a place we plan to go to. The most famous aspect of this plane to the general public is the fact that it has a parachute for the entire plane, so that if you get in some kind of trouble, as you know, I'll explain why we're going to try to avoid that, there's a red handle you pull and a parachute comes out and the whole plane drifts survivably to the ground. The main watchword we're having for this trip is to do no difficult flying. We want the flying to be the most routine part of it, only in good weather, only relatively short hops, only in daytime, because you can get into a lot of trouble in small planes, as people know. So we're sticking to the safe, even boring part of flying, although it's never boring to see the world from a 2,000-foot elevation.
That is true. Jim Fallows, national correspondent for The Atlantic magazine. I'll see you in Sioux Falls on Wednesday, Jim.
Looking forward to it, Kai. Thank you.
Our series with Jim Fallows and The Atlantic magazine is called American Futures. The online version with Jim's blog, extra audio, and a kind of cool high-tech map of our travels is at marketplace.org. And while you're there, you can weigh in with your suggestions for other places for us to stop. Coming up, you know, sometimes, depending on the place, there is more than one story to be told.
One of the first questions I get when I come back to the United States from the Middle East is, what is the Silicon Valley of whatever that place is?
But first, let's do the numbers. After last week's carnage, wait, what? I was out of town. All right, anyway, Wall Street seemed unable to make up its mind today. In the end, the Dow Industrials, off 5 points, basically flat, closed at 15,419. The NASDAQ picked up 9 points, 0.25%, 3669 at the end of the day. The S&P 500 down a single point, about 0.1%, finished at 1689. Two struggling companies staged comebacks today in the markets anywhere. Shares of BlackBerry rang up 10.5%. after the smartphone maker said it may put itself up on the auction block or team up with a partner. JCPenney gained 2.3%. The retailer's board may move against a fellow director and activist shareholder who's pushing for a new CEO. CEOs at that company have been troubled, you might recall. Apple did its part to lift the NASDAQ. Shares added 2.8% on reports the company will unveil a new smartphone next month. Bond prices, why they fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note, why they fell. Yield on the 10-year T-note, rather, rose to 2.62%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Get Marketplace's top headlines, podcasts, and special features delivered right to your inbox each day. Subscribe to the Midday Update newsletter at Marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on retail sales for the month of July. Is the mouse always on the wrong side of the computer? Ice cream difficult to scoop? Drinking glass in an inconvenient place? Tomorrow is Left-Hander's Day. And South Park premiered on Comedy Central on August 13, 1997, killing Kenny for 16 years. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Here's today's lesson that the fundamentals of capitalism don't always work the way you think they're going to work. A report out today from the Department of Agriculture projects a record corn harvest. Prices are down about 40% from last year as a result when drought ruined much of that crop. But as Sarah McCammon reports, cheaper corn does not always mean cheaper food.
Here's a surprise. This year's big harvest is all about supply and demand. Bruce Babcock is an economist at Iowa State University.
Farmers responded to high prices in the past year or two, and they planted a record number of acres.
Now it's almost time to harvest that corn. The USDA projects the biggest crop in history, nearly 30% larger than last year. Nathan Fields is director of economic analysis at the National Corn Growers Association.
What's happened here in 2013 is we've seen a much cooler, wetter year, and that's resulting in some pretty robust supplies.
More supply means lower prices. Corn is trading below $5 a bushel, down from around $7 last year. So since corn is in so many things we eat, will that mean cheaper food?
Nobody's in any hurry to lower prices, believe me.
Bob Golden is vice president of the food industry consulting firm Technomic. He expects food prices to go up, just more slowly.
It's a big budget item, so the fact that food prices are not rising as rapidly as they anticipated is good news for the industry.
And great news for livestock producers who rely on corn for feed. Besides, says Nathan Fields of the Corn Growers, corn is a tiny fraction of the cost of many foods. Take a box of cornflakes,
which costs $3.50 or $4. It's got about 10 cents of corn in there.
The rest is labor, transportation, and marketing, which don't rise and fall with the price of corn. I'm Sarah McCammon for Marketplace.
When Detroit filed for bankruptcy protection a couple of weeks ago, the biggest municipal bankruptcy we've ever had, in case you hadn't heard, the city basically told its creditors to get in line to get paid. Among those creditors standing in line are people who'd bought municipal bonds, muni bonds, as they're called. And now, as Kate Davidson reports, the $3.7 trillion muni market is a tad uneasy.
Battle Creek, Michigan is 120 miles from Detroit, right on the train line, says city finance director Linda Morrison.
There is a lot of noise. There's a lot of trains that come through on a daily basis.
That's why Battle Creek wanted to sell $16 million worth of muni bonds to fund a quiet zone downtown and buy a new fire engine.
Windows in City Hall, yep.
But even though Battle Creek has a good credit rating, some investors are wary about buying Michigan bonds. Some have called it the Detroit penalty. Battle Creek called off its bond sale because investors wanted more interest than the city could afford to pay.
About $200,000 more a year. And some of these projects were going to be paid off over a 5-year period, a 10-year period, and some over a 20-year period.
Lisa Washburn is with Municipal Market Advisors. She says while postponements happen from time to time, this is the third one in Michigan since Detroit declared bankruptcy.
It is a bit unusual to have three transactions so close together in the state of Michigan, all pulled around the same time.
For now, though, this seems to be a case of what happens in Michigan mostly stays in Michigan. That's because Detroit's proposal to treat bondholders just like everyone else that owes money is so unusual. Alan Schenkel analyzes muni bonds for Janney Capital Markets.
Last week, I believe approximately $7 billion worth of bond sales went off pretty much without a hitch.
Recent sales in Connecticut and Washington have gone fine. Schenkel says at the end of the day, there's still a market for munis. The question in Michigan is at what price? I'm Kate Davidson for Marketplace.
The story out of the Middle East the past couple of years has been politics and uprisings, mostly. But Chris Schroeder says there's a revolution over there that's getting a good deal less mainstream attention. A boom in foreign tech companies investing in the region and locals building up new businesses. Schroeder is an investor himself and the author of a new book called Startup Rising, about entrepreneurialism in the Middle East. Chris, thanks for being with us.
Great to be here.
I can't tell, judging by the headlines from Syria and Egypt, whether your timing on this book is terrific or it's terrible.
Yeah, it's an interesting time to be thinking about these things.
Well, and that's the question. Interesting time or a terrible time?
Well, I think all times are interesting times overall. And one of the first questions I get when I come back to the United States from the Middle East or any of my global travels is, what is the Silicon Valley of whatever that place is? And I think Silicon Valley is a very, very unique thing. And what is most interesting happening around the world today is not that there'll be one central anchor, but multiple hubs. Having said that, in the Middle East, I think with what's going on in Egypt right now, some of the most exciting entrepreneurs I've met anywhere are in Cairo, and I see them in Lebanon, and I see them in Saudi Arabia. This is a large consuming region of the world. And it's only the earliest days of people becoming comfortable and using credit cards and transacting online.
Talk to me for a second about that market penetration, about how common the internet is over there, how comfortable people are with this idea of virtual shopping, of social networks and all of that.
So I think that the big story about the Middle East, as it is about emerging markets, is the mass penetration of mobile devices. And what you're talking about is supercomputing capacity in the hands of 50 to 60 to 70 to 80% of people. These are early days, and I think the essence of people being comfortable to shop online, as it was in the United States, is comfort and trust. You know, no one's going to steal my credit card. But I can tell you, 6 months ago, 7 months ago, PayPal just opened up their first operation there. They know exactly what is coming and that people will be looking for alternative e-payment capabilities, and that it's just a matter of time.
You know, we took the show to the Middle East about, 5 years ago this past spring. We were in Dubai. We were in Cairo. We were in broad chunks of that region, and there are some things that we discovered there that I think need to be mentioned. I mean, there's widespread youth unemployment. There are serious problems with migration. There's infrastructure issues. There are human rights problems. I mean, not all of this is all sunshine and light over there.
Not by any stretch of the imagination that I think we find historically innovative people try to find ways to innovate them. And so as you look around at places like China, India, Brazil, where 10 years ago, 15 years ago, we wouldn't have really thought very highly about them as ecosystems. And Lord knows they still have their challenges today. Also, unbelievable, interesting things have happening there. And I think in the challenges, which are very real and will put great pressure on risk capital going forward, at the same time, it's opening up very, very interesting opportunities.
Let me ask you about that risk tolerance. Do you have to have, I mean, acknowledging that it's a developing area and that there are very serious political and social streams of unrest going on, do you have to have a higher than usual risk tolerance to get involved in the Middle East?
There's no question. I think that there are great investors from around the world who look at challenging emerging markets as great opportunity. And there's no question that there are people in Silicon Valley who will turn to me quite rightfully and say, look, I can always do better in the States than I can do in emerging markets. And yet at the same time, as we know, a lot of the great venture capital companies from Europe and the United States have now offices in Brazil where they never would have had them 15 years ago. And it's a matter of what you think of in terms of your global opportunity portfolio, your options, and whether you're willing not to take advantage of these great new changes that are happening on the ground.
The book by Christopher Schroeder is called Startup Rising, about entrepreneurialism in the Middle East. Mr. Schroeder, thanks very much for your time.
Thanks very much for thinking of me.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note on the way out today, which, now that I think of it, brings a whole new meaning to the phrase on the way out. Patch.com, the local news network owned by AOL, has been having some problems, losing bunches of money mostly. So it's cutting the number of cities it covers and laying people off as well. AOL CEO Tim Armstrong had a conference call last week with Patch employees to share the news, about 1,000 of them on the line. He was saying all the usual CEO things that they say, and then this.
Very specific about this is Patch, from an experience, Abel, put that camera down right now. Abel, you're fired. Out.
And that was it. About 10 seconds of silence, then he kept on going with whatever it was he was saying. Fired a guy on a conference call in front of about 1,000 people. No comment from either AOL or Abel Lenz, the guy with the camera, by the way. And with that, we're done. That's Marketplace from APM on this Monday. Today, the Dow off 5 points. We'll call that basically flat. The NASDAQ picked up 9 points. That's 0.25%. The S&P 500 down a single point. That's about 0.1%. Our producers include Lina Anwar, Bridget Bodner, Mary Doon, Nancy Fargali, Millie Jefferson, John Ketchum, Jolie Myers, and Chow Tu. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you back here tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.